Now, my pleasure so much to introduce to you Dr. Edwin Vieira. Dr. Edwin Vieira holds 4 degrees from Harvard. He's graduated from the Harvard Law School, as well as he has a PhD in chemistry. And he has more than 30 years that he's practiced law with an emphasis on constitutional issues. He is also one of our country's most eminent constitutional attorneys, having brought forth 4 cases that were accepted by the U.S. Supreme Court, having won 3 of them. He's the world's foremost authority about the role of our Constitution as it relates to money. Please welcome Dr. Edwin Vieira, Grassroots America, We the People. We appreciate you being here, Doctor.
Thank you, George. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I don't think I can live up to that fulsome introduction, but I will say this. George earlier alluded to this, or at least he made the suggestion, that some of my presentation would be on the pessimistic side. Well, people sometimes say that, but you know what the definition of a pessimist is? A pessimist is an optimist who knows the facts. Now, we are living in a period which more and more people are recognizing as laden with increasingly severe crises, particularly in the financial area. And the Chinese character for crisis contains 2 ideas: danger on the one side and opportunity on the other. So that's the optimistic side of this fundamentally pessimistic coin. So first, let's clear the decks on the pessimistic side. Back in 2004, which was the Bush-Kerry election, the unfunded liabilities of the general government, what's often called the federal government in Washington, D.C., were estimated to be approximately $55 trillion. In 2006, an economist at Boston University named Kotlikoff did a very careful study, and he determined that the unfunded liabilities were approximately $65 trillion. On Wednesday, I attended a conference with some rather eminent financial people, and the estimate now is approximately $115 trillion. Well, these are astronomical numbers, akin to the distance between the Earth and Alpha Centauri, or one of the other stars out there in another solar system. And they really, in a financial sense, they are unpayable debts. And Mr. Obama was on television yesterday telling the country that he had set up this new deficit control commission. Well, assume that worked and they could come up with a surplus of $1 trillion every year for the general government. It would only take them 115 years to pay off these liabilities, which of course are coming due before the 115-year period ends. So it seems like something of an impossibility. Now, interestingly enough, though, it is true that all debts are always paid. Either the debtor pays them, or the creditor pays them, right, in real terms, or some third-party guarantor or surety comes in and he pays them. In other words, somebody always pays the freight, somebody always bears the load in any system of this kind. Now, the question is, politically speaking, what now? What next? This is where we find ourselves. What next? And I keep thinking back to the analogy of the football coach, and he will train each individual on that team in blocking, in tackling, in running, in pass catching, in kicking, whatever the specialty is. But that's not enough. He has to put those people together and organize them in specific units, teams. You need an offensive team, you need a defensive team, you need a kickoff team, you need a punt return team, whatever. But that's not enough. He has to have a game plan, and that game plan has to depend upon a number of factors. What's the opposition? How strong or weak are they? Where's this game being played, home or away? What's the weather going to be like? And that game plan may have many sub-plans within it, because certainly you're going to play the game differently if you're ahead 35 to nothing in the second quarter than you would if you were behind 40 to 7 in the fourth quarter. So one has to make some kind of evaluation of politically and economically where we are at the present time. And not just in terms of the pessimistic number 115 trillion, because fundamentally that can be finessed in one way or another. Well, I would say, continuing the football analogy for a moment, that we are on a 2-yard line, we have the ball, we're behind 15 to nothing, and there's about 3 minutes left in the fourth quarter. So we have to come up with a way to score 2 touchdowns and 2 two-point conversions in the next 3 minutes. And that will depend on 2 things. First, on the opposition, and then on ourselves. Now, going back to that Chinese character, danger and opportunity, we have an opportunity because the other side has put itself in a fantastically vulnerable position. Financially speaking, the major institution in this country, the Federal Reserve System, they're riding a tiger, and they don't dare get off, because if they do, the tiger will consume them. You can see the analogy. On the other side, there is a growing awareness on the part of the people of this country that something is fundamentally wrong. I mean, the Tea Party movement's a good example of that. The Ron Paul phenomenon during the last election was another example of it. There are many, many people who do not understand the specifics of the problem. They certainly don't have a clue yet about a direction in which one can move towards a solution. But they realize something is wrong. The cause is in Washington and the solution is not. And that's the beginning of changing the game plan in the right direction. Now, what I have put up on the screen here is actually a very busy diagram that was used over 2 days in a presentation, so I'm not going to try and take you through it. My main point to make is that the fundamental solution here does not lie in Washington, and at least initially it does not lie even in the state capitals. It lies right here with people such as yourselves. It lies with the 3 most important words in the U.S. Constitution, which are, we the people, all right? We the people. And actually, that terminology is used as well in the Declaration of Independence. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce the people under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government. Now just stop right there. It is their right. But the Declaration goes further. It is their duty, all right? Their moral duty, their legal duty, their theological duty, because the Declaration of Independence takes us back to what? The laws of nature and of nature's God, which are superior to the people, and the people are supposed to work totally within that context. It is their duty. Well, if it is their duty to go so far as to throw off a government when a long train of abuses and usurpations leads to this conclusion, it is certainly their duty to prevent that long train of abuses and usurpations from starting in the first place, or to correct it before it's necessary to take the extreme action of throwing off a government. Now, how is this to be done? Well, the people in our system are not outside of the government looking in. You know, a lot of people tend to think about the governmental structure in this country as being pyramidal. Now, this huge pyramid, and on top there's the all-seeing eye from the back of the seal on the Federal Reserve. There's the all-seeing eye. And that's the general government in Washington, D.C. And then below that, there are the states, and below that, there are the localities, and then way at the bottom, there are the people. And the concept that most people have when they look at that kind of a picture is it's a bureaucratic organizational chart. Power is always at the top. That's where the leadership group is, and then the rest are, to some degree or other, followers, but there's less and less power as they go down the pyramidal structure. And in fact, we've seen that has been the direction in which political power and legal claims to power, at least, have moved. Certainly over the course of my lifetime, they've moved from the bottom to the top. They've been taken away from the states and concentrated in the general government in Washington, and then centralized in Congress, and then Congress has delegated those powers to the executive branch, and the executive branch has personalized those powers in the president. So now you can't look at the popular media without hearing the president says this, the president wants that, this is the president's budget, this is the president's proposal, as if we were following some called the leader principle. Now, the correct language in which to describe the leader principle is not English, but German. Das Führerprinzip. And we can remember who made that principle, Das Führerprinzip, infamous. All right? This thing is something that is entirely contrary and contradictory of the American structure of government. In our form of government, authority is not at the top with the leader. The authority increases as you go down the pyramid. The strength of a pyramid is never in its apex, it is always in its base. Now, when we think about it that way, we have to ask ourselves a question. Well, where in this legal system, constitutional system, do we find the ability of the people directly to intervene in the process? Well, obviously, one way is through the electoral process, which we've been talking about today. Right? You can vote for candidates. But that vote comes once every 2 years, or once every 4 years, or once every 6 years, and what happens in between? Right? What's the control mechanism in between? Well, I like to focus on the two great powers of government, power of the purse and the power of the sword. Anyone who's conversant with political philosophy will recognize those. You can trace those back to ancient Rome, ancient Greece, and so forth and so on. And our Constitution was very carefully designed to maintain those powers fundamentally in the hands of whom? We the people, because we the people were the ones then who did ordain and establish the Constitution and are required by the Declaration of Independence to maintain this system in its pristine state. Now, let me have the second of those, if I can. I want to look at the fiscal system first, the monetary system, because this is the one that is now threatening us with imminent economic disaster. The constitutional system was derived to limit the government's ability to gain control of economic resources. Why? Because it's a limited government. There are only so many things that it can do, or is supposed to do, and therefore it only needs a limited number of resources. And we know perfectly well that if you give too many resources to a politician, he'll find some way to use them in an abusive fashion. So it was designed to limit the ability of the government to control financial resources and to maximize the ability of the people to maintain their control over financial resources. So the government, which is engaged ultimately in spending, that's what governments do, right? They buy services or provide services, they spend money. Where would they get the money? Well, they could get it from taxation. And the feedback loop there was that the taxpayers, if they were dissatisfied with how their money was being spent, would go at least into the electoral process and change the composition of the legislature. The government could also obtain money by borrowing from the private markets. But if the markets thought that the government was being profligate, they'd demand higher rates of interest. It would be more difficult to borrow. So there was a check and balance built into the economic system there. The third method was money, creation of money. Well, the only way under the Constitution that the general government can create money, and the states can't create money at all, is two ways, actually. There are two ways. One, if the government happened to have gold and silver mines on public land, it could mine that gold and silver and coin it into gold and silver coinage. The other method was what was called free coinage. The government would open the mints to whoever had gold and silver to be minted. It would come there, it would be coined, so that you'd have a certification that this piece of metal contained so much gold, contained so much silver. And then that coinage would go back into the marketplace where it would be subject to taxation or borrowing. So the amount of the money supply even was going to be controlled by the free market, because gold and silver require capital and labor to be taken out of the ground, refined, mined, refined, and so forth before they can become coinage. And if that capital and labor can find a more profitable use somewhere else, it won't be put into excessive production of gold and silver for any purpose, let alone coinage. So you had a very strict limitation on the government, now in Washington, D.C., in terms of how the political sector could get its hands on resources, and that meant that the political sector quite often would have to say no to the special interest groups. No, we can't fund this, even if we wanted to, even if we thought we could bend the limits on our powers with respect to funding, we can't raise the money. The people control the money. Well, that was a very unsolicitous way of looking at things. They didn't like that. So they came up with a much better system, which I've called the confidence game fiscal system. And we put into the middle of this system a new block called the Federal Reserve System, which is a quasi-private, quasi-public banking cartel, very similar in structure to what Mussolini set up in the Italian fascist state, very similar to what Mr. Franklin Roosevelt set up in the National Industrial Recovery Administration, which, by the way, was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in 1935. The only reason this system is still with us, it wasn't declared unconstitutional, was because it was a different statute that covered the banks. The statute that the Supreme Court dealt with covered all the other industries in the country, and they declared that unconstitutional. In any event, what the Federal Reserve System allows the central government to do is to monetize debt. Now it's not so much the private market that's controlling the ability to borrow, but it's the Federal Reserve System, and the Federal Reserve System, of course, has an interest in monetizing governmental debt, because, of course, it was created by the government. All right, it's not really a private entity. And then on the other hand, the Federal Reserve System, or the member banks in the Federal Reserve System, are making their private profits how? By lending money, right? So they have an interest in increasing the money supply. Now, engineers, if there are any out here in the audience, know that it's very dangerous if you have any kind of mechanical system that does not have a negative feedback loop to control excesses. This is a system without a negative feedback loop. In fact, all of the loops in this system are driving it in one direction, towards increasing the money supply, increasing debt, and making it increasingly difficult to pay off that debt with real value, as opposed to paying off the debt with money of decreased purchasing power. $115 trillion just in governmental debt alone. We're not counting the private debt, $115 trillion. I think I can say here with absolute surety that if we had not had the Federal Reserve System in operation since 1913, 1933, 1971, whichever one of the breakpoints you want to take in the history of that operation, it would have been impossible to have generated this level of debt. Not simply unlikely, not simply difficult, but impossible. All right. So the present financial circumstances of this country are tied directly to the existence of that entity. Now let's look at the other side here, these people who are riding the tiger. What is the one thing they don't want to do? They don't want to get off, right? They don't want to get off. Because if they get off, they'll lose their wealth, their social position, their political position, their pensions, heaven knows what. Right. So they have to ride this system as far as it will go, even if it takes the country down with them. And one thing they recognize, that if you have a hyperinflationary event, which is a situation in which the purchasing power of the currency drops rapidly into the abyss, you will have social and economic dislocations of a profound nature. It's happened in every country in the world. The classic example is the Weimar hyperinflation in 1923. In 6 months, they completely destroyed the currency, and every economic historian, probably every political historian in the world today would agree that as a consequence of that, political parties became very powerful in Germany. It led eventually to the takeover by the Nazis in 1933. 10 years later, they had the Nazi Party, 70 million people killed in World War II, and you can go on and on and on with the horrors of that. All right, traced back, at least in part and in substantial part, to the hyperinflation in Weimar Germany. All right. So they can look down the road. They're not all fools in Washington. They may be knaves, but they're not all fools. They can look down the road and see this may be the consequence of maintaining the system in operation that they have to maintain in operation. So they have a fallback position. They have a game plan for the last 2 minutes. And that is their homeland security game plan, which is the imposition of some kind of centrally controlled, pyramidal, top-down, from the all-seeing eye outward police state operation in this country when the economy completely collapses. And they are even now talking about bringing in, unfortunately, the armed forces into this. The NORTHCOM organization has been really beefed up for exactly that reason. There aren't enough, as the expression goes, boots on the ground if you have a national economic collapse, especially given that the local and state police are going to be worried about their own families. They may not be willing to take orders from Washington. So you have to be able to bring in enough people to restore order, as the expression goes, right? You saw how they restored order in New Orleans after Katrina, or during Katrina. All right. So they're already planning this. This is the homeland security aspect. And I want to make a couple of comments here about homeland security. I'm actually working on that now more than on the monetary issue, because I think the monetary issue, we know the answer to it. The question now is, what do we do on the other side of the coin? What do we do if we can't bring this economic crisis under some element of control? And I like to think of the roller coaster analogy. You know, the roller coaster is going up the funicular, the ratchet. Click, 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 click. The cars are being brought up to the apex of the roller coaster. We're about two or three clicks away from the top. Now, once that first car goes over the edge, gravity takes over, and it's almost in free fall. The whole series goes with it. There's no way to stop it. All right. So, number one, you have to stop the roller coaster system now, at this particular point, because if you don't, it goes out of control. I think even the other side understands it will be out of control. And the picture that comes to my mind is the roller coaster looks like one of those space pictures of the moon. On one side, it's absolutely bright, and on the other side, it's absolutely dark. On the side with the cars, it's absolutely light. We can see how to get back down. It won't be easy. It won't be cheap. It'll take a while, but we can see how to get back down. If the cars go over the top, they go into the black hole, and we have no idea what's there. There has never been an experience like this in this country before. All right? Well, when you have this kind of a problem with any kind of an implement, whether it's a chainsaw or an automobile, government, what are you supposed to do as the operator? And we, the people, are the operators of this government. You go back to the book of instructions. That's the first thing you do. You go back to the book of instructions. And what does the Constitution tell us about security? And the terminology they like to use in Washington now is homeland security. So let me use that terminology. Not that I like it, but it's their term, and it takes a crooked stick to beat a mad dog, so I'm perfectly willing to use their terminology. All right. Homeland security. Where in the Constitution does the word security appear? Anyone want to venture a guess? Only one place. Second Amendment. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of the free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And where in the Constitution does the cognate, the verb, secure, appear? In the preamble. We the people, right, in order to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, to ordain and establish this Constitution. Okay? So when we look at the Second Amendment and the preamble, we see the word security, and it's not the security of just any old state. It's not the security of a totalitarian state. It's not the security of a socialist state, right? It's the security of a free state. And that's tied to the concept of the blessings of liberty for whom? the people, all right? That's quite a bit different from the kind of homeland security that's being set up in Washington, D.C. now, which has more of the character of a police state, somewhat different concept. Right? Now, also when we read the Second Amendment, it says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. That's the only place in the Constitution that it says any institution or establishment is necessary for any purpose. It doesn't say Congress is necessary, and we know that's true. Right? It doesn't say the president is necessary. It doesn't say the judicial system is necessary. It doesn't say the army or the navy is necessary. The only thing the Constitution recognizes being necessary to this ultimate purpose, because that is the ultimate purpose of the Constitution, maintaining the security of a free state, is a well-regulated militia. Now, what is that? Not a bunch of people running around in the woods in camouflage outfits with AK-47 clone-type rifles? No. Now, the Constitution doesn't define the term a well-regulated militia. A lot of terms the Constitution doesn't define. It doesn't define jury or jury trial. It doesn't define a republican form of government. It doesn't define piracy, the law of nations, run down the list of things it doesn't define. It defines such things as Congress, House of Representatives and Senate. Why? Because this Congress was something new, and they didn't want it confused with the Congress of the Articles of Confederation. It defines the president. That was a completely new office. It never existed before. Defines the judicial system, because the jurisdiction of these courts had never been heard of before. But most everything else in the Constitution had been heard of before, and the presumption was that the people at that time knew precisely what those terms meant. They knew what a jury was and trial by jury. And they knew what a well-regulated militia was, because everyone from 16 to 60 who was able-bodied, who wasn't a woman, because women were not legally emancipated at that time, was serving in one or had served in one. And many of them had fought in the Revolutionary War in these militia organizations, maybe as far back as the French and Indian Wars in the late 1750s. So they knew precisely what these entities were. They knew what a well-regulated militia was. Why? Because there had been dozens and dozens of statutes passed during the colonial period describing precisely the characteristics of these organizations. And in fact, the titles of these statutes are often an act to regulate the militia of Virginia, North Carolina, an act to amend an act to regulate the militia of, an act to improve the regulation of the militia of. All right? They knew precisely what these were, and what were they? Well, they were state institutions, as the Constitution calls them, the militia of the several states. They were essentially local organizations of people who were trained for the purpose of dealing with what we would call today homeland security. Usually it was of a quasi-military nature, because they had problems with the Indians or with the French or later with the British. But they were certainly capable of dealing with essentially anything that we would consider to be emergency response today, or homeland security. And just as we do have a Federal Reserve system that we don't need, we don't have, in any state in this union, any one of the 50 states, a constitutional, well-regulated militia according to the pre-constitutional pattern. Not a single one. Right? And this is really the challenge, because to deal with the problem that the breakdown of the Federal Reserve System is going to impose upon us in terms of economic dislocation at the local and state level, we are going to need to revitalize these institutions in each state that the Constitution itself tells us are necessary to the security of a free state. Can I have the next one of these charts? Now, here, for instance, is one idea for doing so. The Federal Reserve System can't be abolished tomorrow. You can't pass a statute that says the Federal Reserve System no longer exists. Why? Because the entire economy runs on a Federal Reserve note price standard. When you go into the grocery store, you go into Walmart, that price, what they call dollars, they expect you to pay in Federal Reserve notes. Or at least they'll accept them, and they'll pay the green paper. If you are going to replace this system, you have to give the country an alternative currency with which to price goods and services. A sound alternative currency, a constitutional alternative currency, an alternative currency consisting of gold or silver, or better, gold and silver. Question is, how do you do this? Well, this is not going to be given to you by the Federal Reserve. Federal Reserve system spent from 1913 to 1971 desperately trying to remove gold and silver from the system, and they were effective in doing so. Congress is not going to give you that kind of alternative. I mean, Ron Paul has put some bills in, he's talked about it, but he's one voice crying in the wilderness. And it is quite a wilderness up there in Congress. This has to be done further down the pyramid, where there is more authority for doing it and more responsibility for doing it at the state level. Because the states do have the constitutional authority not to create their own currency, but to choose to use some currency that's already been created as an alternative currency for their own governmental functions. In fact, the Supreme Court decided that at least two times during the 19th century. So it is certainly possible that a state could pass legislation creating an alternative competitive currency system within its own governmental functions, and then eventually, one would hope, within the state economy, that would allow the citizens of the state to use a currency in competition with Federal Reserve notes. Then what do you think would happen? Well, if a person has the choice between a rotting vegetable currency and a currency that maintains its value, which one does he choose if he's rational? Right? Okay. So what you would see if such a system was set up, as the weaknesses of the Federal Reserve structure became more and more apparent to people, everyone would begin to move his financial transactions, or if you're a business, the business transactions, or the state, if it's the state's transactions, away from the Federal Reserve system and into the alternative currency system. And this would allow prices to develop on a rational basis over a reasonable period of time, a certain amount of stability. Right? You'd still have a lot of overhang of debt. You'd have to revalue things and repudiate some, and there are a lot of other techniques that we'd have to look at because of the debt problem. But at least you wouldn't be left with an economy that was entirely prostrate and no currency that was capable of functioning in a rational fashion. Are they doing this in Washington? No. So where do we have to do it? Here. I don't know, Texas, but someplace. Because the first state that does this will be the exemplar for the rest of the country, given that there is no other alternative. You cannot get out of this system without coming up with a new monetary structure. End of discussion. QED. The first state that does this will be the savior, assuming that we all last long enough, will be the economic savior of the country. Now, the only thing I want to add to this is this other line here, the red line at the bottom. And the grave difficulty in any one of these situations of alternative currencies is, well, you can get the state apparatus to do this because it's just a statute you pass and the state has to do it, right? It's going to tax and it's going to spend. But can you get the people here down below in the private economy to do this? One second. Oh, okay. Can you get the people in the private economy to do it? And the answer is, well, if you have enough time, people are rational creatures, they'll see the advantage of doing it, and it will simply happen. This is what happened in Europe with the introduction of the euro. They put in competing currencies, the euro and whatever the local currency was, the lira, the peseta, and so forth and so on. And then slowly but surely they withdrew the local currency, leaving the European system with the euro as its main currency. But it took a fair amount of time, and they were engaged in a crisis situation. Right? I don't think we have that amount of time to allow the private market to equilibrate on its own. And that's where the militia structure comes in. Because the statute would simply say, because of course everyone from 16 to 60 is a member of the militia, all of you businessmen out there, you have 60 days to come up with an alternative price structure for your goods and services. The state will give you the software. You're all using barcodes anyway. I mean, the technology is here to do it. Within 60 days, we want you to figure out what your alternative prices are going to be in this new currency. And what does that mean? That means within 60 days, the entire economy of that state can be entirely off the Federal Reserve System if the consumers in that state are willing to use the alternative currency. We the people can literally walk away from the Federal Reserve System. We don't need to gain control of Congress. Right? We don't need to change the hearts and the minds of the forces of darkness that lurk in the District of Columbia. Right? All we need to do is to get a majority in a state legislature made up of people whose IQs are 1 point higher than their ages. Because literally, I don't think you need an IQ 1 point higher than your age to see the advantage of this, especially when the economy is crumbling on top of your own head. Now, I will just say that I have drafted some bills for doing this, and I'm sure there are other people out there that can do just as well or better. This is a competitive operation. Let's get as many people working, as many people in the vineyard as possible. If you want to see a typical bill, you can go to a website, goldmoneybill.org, www.goldmoneybill.org. It shows a gold currency bill that was drafted for the state of New Hampshire. A similar bill was picked up in Indiana. There was a bill in Colorado. There was a bill in Montana. There's something that's similar to this in Georgia. And I hear various rumors that other states are picking it up. So far, none of these bills have wended their way out of committee, but of course that's the problem of having enough legislators in there who understand this matter and are willing to take it on. So there is a movement out there in the direction that I'm proposing. One of the most difficult problems I think you're going to face, this is where I'm going to leave you. I have talked to a number of state legislators who have given me a negative reaction to this whole business because they say, this is not a state problem. This is not a state question. Right? We're state legislators. We're only supposed to be legislating for our state. This is a federal question. This is a Federal Reserve question. All right? Well, there you see. All right. It's something that, in a sense, is laughable on the face of it. But yet, that's the feedback. And I think, really, that's a matter of denial. They don't want to face up to the responsibility. They have to recognize we need to do this, and they don't want to face up to that. That's where you people come in. Not only the matter of educating these people about this, but pointing out it is their responsibility as state legislators. It's not going to be done in Washington. It can't be done by individuals. It would take too long. It has to be done at the state level. So I'm very heartened to see the extent to which you've organized yourselves, the enthusiasm here, and what I feel is really the knowledge and commitment to bringing some semblance of constitutional government back to this country. And I appreciate the opportunity to be able to talk to you. Thank you. I have a few questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Vieira. We really appreciate your time, and you're a very busy man, we know, and we appreciate you coming. Question, in my opinion, you are the one and only at Harvard. How do you survive with all the seeming to be the far left at that institution?
Actually, the reason was I started off in natural science. So in college days and then the graduate school, I was in the chemistry department. Well, in natural science, double talk doesn't work very well. I mean, literally, you can tell nature how you want things to come out, but then nature tells you how they will come out. All right? And you perform the experiment, you see if it doesn't work. If it doesn't work, you have to change the parameters. You have to change your mindset, right? You can't operate like a politician. Now, when I went to law school, that's the one thing I discovered, that law in this country was not scientific. It was not empirical. It was not really concerned with getting at facts and legal principles. It was concerned with getting results, right? What's in it for my family, as Don Corleone would say. But I can't believe any science, well, I shouldn't say that. Most scientists shouldn't, because now we have the global warming thing, so maybe I should just be quiet.
Why is inflation not skyrocketing right now?
Well, the interesting question with inflation is, what's your definition? All right. If your definition is in price increases alone, you can imagine a situation in which the market is trying to drive down prices, and the banks or the treasury are putting out paper currency, the result of which should be to raise prices. So you could have a massive inflation of the currency with prices remaining stable, in fact, prices even going down. Now, what we're seeing here with the TARP bailouts and so forth to the banks, for some reason or other, they're holding this back from lending. So we haven't seen that get out yet. But the reality is, what's the Treasury deficit going to be this year? How many trillion? At least one and a half, something along that line? All right. There's where the new money is coming from, monetization of debt. You're going to see at least that much this year. I don't make economic predictions, but watch around September, October, sometime in the fall.
Are we in a depression? If not, how far are we from it?
Well, the level of unpayable debt would tend to suggest that we could go into depression tomorrow, but my suggestion is that we're first going to have a hyperinflation. They're going to try and prevent it. Their idea is that they can prevent depression by stimulating through creation of new money. They can keep inflating the bubble. All right. I think they learned that from the Roosevelt era, right, from the 1930s. So they will try that first. And what that might result in is the worst of all possible worlds, a hyperinflationary depression, where everybody's out of work and the currency is depreciating to zero. And who will that hurt? Well, the old people, people on any kind of pension, Social Security, as a for instance, they're going to be wiped out. Anybody who is a creditor, long-term creditor, he's going to be wiped out. He's going to be paid in depreciated currency. And meanwhile, everyone's going to be out of work. That's why I say they're riding a tiger. They're playing with fire. There's nobody who knows how deep that black hole is going to be.
What section of the tax code makes the average private citizen liable for a tax on their wages or salary?
I think none that I know of. No. No, but then I'm not a tax expert. Actually, the tax expert is, where is the tax? John Green. Yeah, John Green.
Uh-huh. What is your opinion of the consumption tax, i.e. fair tax?
Well, I'm not sure which the fair tax. The consumption tax is an excise tax, or a sales tax. The grave difficulty is you can't put a sales tax. A sales tax is always regressive. Unless you give some kind of exemption at the lower income levels, who is really going to end up paying the most of that tax? But on the other hand, if you look at the constitutional intent, I think, of the framers, they wanted the government to be funded with consumption taxes, tariffs. I mean, this government was run until when? Until Wilson, I think. Until the Wilson administration, primarily on the basis of tariff revenue. And that's one form of consumption, that's a form of sales tax in terms of entry into the marketplace.
What are some ways we can protect ourselves from the coming inflation?
Well, one way, of course, is to diversify into some amount of hard money. The only hard money is being gold and silver. In fact, on Wednesday at the conference, an interesting figure came up that given the level of hyperinflation being predicted at the conference, tell me if I'm wrong, Tom, that Victor said 15% of one's portfolio in gold would get you through, given the level of hyperinflation we expect to see. So it's not a matter that you have to go out, liquidate everything, turn into gold and silver coins and bury it in the backyard. 15% of that liquid investment capital, if put into gold, would probably protect you through the type of hyperinflation we're worried about.
How would a state deal with the federal government attempting to enforce the law that states that all entities must accept the Federal Reserve notes?
Well, A, that's not the law. The legal tender law is very peculiar. Most people don't understand it. There's a section of the Monetary Code, Title 31, United States Code, Section 5118D2, D as in dog, 5118D2, which allows anyone to make what's called a gold clause contract. That is a contract that requires payment in something other than Federal Reserve notes. It's called a gold clause contract because typically that's what people used. But you could make a private contract requiring payment in silver, requiring payment in gold, requiring payment in euros, whatever. Takes you completely outside of the legal tender law. That's number one. Any private citizen can do that. And that's perfectly legal. It's a little cumbersome because you have to sit down with somebody to write the contract out properly, but it's perfectly legal. As far as the states are concerned, the states have absolutely no liability under the legal tender law. The states can declare that they will refuse to accept Federal Reserve notes in payment of taxes. And that's the end of it. It's already been decided by the Supreme Court of the United States. They were talking about Treasury notes, because we didn't have the Federal Reserve System in the late 1800s, but the Treasury notes were generated at least by the Treasury, not by some private banking cartel. So the principle of those Supreme Court decisions would apply today.
Maybe you already answered this. What is your time frame on the demise of the dollar?
certainly within my lifetime, a lot shorter than that. I think we're going to see some very serious... let me put it this way. I hate to make exact predictions, not being, you know, a fortune teller. 5 years at the outside? 5 years at the outside?
Other than TEEP rallies and contacting our government officials, what, in your opinion, should we be doing at the state levels across the nation?
Well, number one, what you're already doing to take over the system from the inside. But you also need, in that process, to be sure that what you're promoting are the most important issues. Right, this is now a matter of priority. In the emergency room, somebody comes in, they're split open, they have acne. Which do you treat first? Right? Okay. Well, if you're from Washington, you might treat acne first, because I don't know. This is the major problem. This is bleeding us to death right here. And the consequence of not treating this problem is going to be great social and economic dislocation, the response to which has to be local control. There's no way Washington can deal with that. So those two elements, and I keep repeating those wherever I go, the people have to regain at the local and state level the power of the purse through an alternative currency in their state government, and the power of the sword through the revitalization of these militia structures, again through the state government, because it requires a state statute to do it constitutionally. If we had the second of those, if we had something that was, say, 15% as good or 20% as good as what the Swiss have and have had for decades, I wouldn't be as worried about the financial collapse. The reason the financial collapse is so frightening is because people are not prepared to deal with the economic and social dislocation. Personally, they don't have the food, the water, the medicine, the equipment, the training. They're not organized in groups even within their own locality, your own neighbor, right? You go meet your neighbor, but you're not part of an organized group with that neighbor. Right? None of that.
Not yet.
But time is getting shorter and shorter.
Let's give Dr. Vieira a great big thank you. Grassroots America, we the people, thanks you, Dr. Vieira, so much for sharing